The Cooper Heart Institute supports WHYY. Their multidisciplinary team of cardiologists introduces the new Watchman device, a minimally invasive treatment option designed to reduce the need for long-term blood thinners in patients with non-valvular atrial fibrillation, thereby reducing the risk of AFib-related stroke. The Cooper Heart Institute is a comprehensive heart care center with offices throughout South Jersey. Details at cooperhealth.org/watchman.
Congressman Shaka Fatah made his first appearance in federal court today and said he's done nothing wrong. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Last month, prosecutors indicted the Philadelphia Democrat for allegedly stealing taxpayer dollars, misusing campaign funds, and even taking a bribe. Since then, he's been energetically maintaining his innocence, as WHYY's Bobby Allen explains.
After Fatah's quick arraignment, where he pled not guilty to all 29 charges, he took some questions from reporters outside the federal courthouse. Then-supporter Sharon Burdett walked by and saw a gaggle of cameras around someone she recognized.
I was like, that's Shaka Fatah, hi!
Burdett pushed through the crowd and shook Fatah's hand before the TV reporters piled on the questions.
So disappointed on what's going on with you right now. Everything going to work out. You's a good guy. You's a good guy.
Fatah, for his part, also is disappointed and thinks he's a good guy. In the face of a federal indictment that accuses him of illegally repaying a $1 million campaign loan with government money and also taking an $18,000 bribe from a lobbyist. Despite that, Fatah says he's focused on his constituents and winning re-election.
After I leave here today, I'm going to return to my work representing the people of the district. I'm going to be a candidate for re-election in the next year's primary for my 12th term in the Congress.
Fatah called me before the court hearing to expand on the brief words he'd planned to speak in front of the federal judge.
This is not what it appears to be, okay? That they got the goods, you know, I'm off to the caboose. The whole indictment is false.
The 11-term Democrat is free on $100,000 bail and had to forfeit his regular passport. Federal prosecutors agreed to let him keep his diplomatic passport for travel as a U.S. congressman. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
Without immediate action, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf warns that the Chester Upland School District won't be in a financial position to open its doors next month. As WHYY's Kevin McCory reports, Wolf has a plan to rectify the situation, partly on the backs of area charter schools.
Governor Wolf has requested a Delaware County judge to approve a drastic reduction in the payments that Chester Upland sends to charter schools. Without action, Wolf says Chester Upland's almost $24 million operating deficit will prevent it from opening in September.
For the life of me, don't know how you can open financially with what they're staring at.
Wolf's solution hinges on what many education advocates have long considered a flaw in the way the state funds charter schools for special education students. In the current system, charters have a financial incentive to enroll students with relatively mild disabilities. It works like this. Districts must give charters whatever the district spends on average on special education. If a charter enrolls many kids with less costly needs, the charter makes out financially, and then a vicious cycle is created. With fewer mildly disabled students in the district, the district's average cost climbs, which it then must pay to the charter. Right now, Chester Upland sends about $40,000 to a charter that enrolls just one area special education student. Wolf wants to implement a new formula in Chester Upland that would align charter special ed payments nearer to actual costs. That would save $21 million.
Special education issue is something that the charter schools and public schools all across the Commonwealth are struggling with. There's an inducement to try to categorize more students than maybe should be categorized as special education just because of the way the formula works.
Wolf also wants to cap funds the state's cyber charters receive for students from Chester Upland to just under $6,000, saving the district another $4 million. Wolf's twofold approach would wipe away the district's existing deficit. If approved by the courts, Wolf's plan would have a large impact on the amount of funding received by the Chester Community Charter School, which enrolls about half the kids living in Chester Upland. Data show that the school enrolls a large special ed population, but disproportionately serves children with less costly needs. Wolf says his proposal is not a direct jab at CCCS.
Yeah, it's not. It's pointed at trying to make sure that the Chester Upland School District is able to open for all kids on time.
Without action, Chester Upland's deficit will almost double by the end of the school year. For WHYY News, I'm Kevin McCrory.
A national coalition of gay and lesbian Catholic groups will hold workshops and discussions about homosexuality and faith during the week the Pope visits Philadelphia. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that they will not be allowed to conduct those meetings at a Catholic church.
During the World Meeting of Families, the Catholic Conference before the Pope's visit in September, dozens of panels and workshops will address a range of religious issues. On top of that, a coalition of Catholic, gay, and lesbian groups called Equally Blessed is planning its own program off-site, specifically about gender identity issues. It had arranged to use the Church of St. John the Evangelist, two blocks from the convention center. One of those coalition groups is called New Ways Ministry. It's based in Maryland, and its director is Francis DiBernardo. Last week, he got a call from the St. John's pastor.
The pastor called our office and said that he had received a phone call from an official at the Archdiocese of Philadelphia who said the Archbishop had seen the brochure about the gender identity workshop, and the pastor told us that the Archbishop wanted the program canceled.
That pastor, John Dea, could not be reached for comment. For his gay and lesbian program, DiBernardo has secured another location, a Methodist church across the street from the convention center. While Pope Francis has made gestures toward the gay community, Philadelphia's Archbishop, Charles Chaput, firmly stands behind the Vatican's official position of not condoning same-sex relationships. The World Meeting of Families will host one session about gay and lesbian issues. It's called Always Consider the Person. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
While those LGBT groups have not received a welcoming embrace from the Archdiocese and World Meeting of Families, others in our area are feeling a new attraction to the Catholic Church. The number of men in our region seeking to become Catholic priests took a dive in the mid-2000s when the church was rocked by the clergy sex abuse scandal. That trend, though, is starting to reverse itself, and as WHYY's Katie Culinary reports, some say it's part of a phenomenon known as the Francis effect.
5 years ago, Father Michael Romano was happily serving as a parish priest in South Jersey when the Archbishop of Camden gave him a new assignment. Now he was going to be the diocese vocation director, the guy in charge of recruiting new men who felt called to become priests. Suddenly, Romano wasn't so happy.
When I started, it was a little depressing.
Morale was low in the church following the scandals, not to mention a slew of parish and school closures. When Romano came in, the Diocese of Camden was sending only one or two new guys to seminary each year.
And then all of a sudden, the summer of 2013 into the fall of 2013, more men started making contact with me.
They started showing up at Romano's monthly meetings for those considering the priesthood. At first, just four or five guys came, then eight, then a dozen. This year, nine men from the Diocese of Camden are starting seminary. It's the diocese's largest crop of new seminarians since 2000. Allentown and Philadelphia are also seeing a significant increase in new vocations over last year. So, what's changed?
Abemus Papam.
Pope Francis was elected in March 2013, and after years of bad press, the popular pontiff is getting the church some more positive headlines. The Archdiocese of Philadelphia's vocation director, Father Stephen DeLacy, believes the bump in new seminarians has a lot to do with that. He calls it the Francis effect. DeLacy didn't make up the term, but the Francis effect has become a moniker for a shift in attitude toward the Catholic Church.
He's not changing any of the dogma, but he's dynamic in his ability to outreach, which then stirs up in the heart of young men, especially those who are called to the priesthood, this capability that, you know, the church is relevant. The church can be dynamic today.
But is the Francis effect really driving more men to join the priesthood?
I've definitely heard the term a lot. I'm not exactly sure what it means, to be 100% honest with you. I mean, I've heard it thrown around a lot.
Philip Moss is 24, and after years of thinking and praying about it, he's finally decided to start seminary this year. It's a decision that stretches back to the playground at his Catholic elementary school, when he just kind of blurted out to a friend that he might become a priest someday. But Ma says Pope Francis's popularity has made some difference for him.
It has definitely increased my excitement about the decision to go in just because it is a very interesting time in the world, definitely, an exciting time in the church.
Giuseppe Esposito feels the same way. He's going back to seminary after a long hiatus as a nurse at Good Shepherd Hospital in Allentown. Esposito's co-workers were big fans of Pope Francis, which made it a lot easier to tell them he was leaving nursing to become a priest.
And it kind of gave me an in to talk about my faith to people who wouldn't normally bring it up.
Church leaders see the increase in new seminarians as a positive, but they're not declaring victory in reversing a long-term priest shortage. Entering seminary is just one step in a long process called discernment, and not everyone makes it to ordination day. Mary Goche has been watching these trends on a national level for 20 years. She's a senior associate at the Center for Applied Research in the Apostolate at Georgetown University. In the 1950s and 60s, Goche says the Catholic Church couldn't build seminaries fast enough to accommodate all the men who felt called to be priests. Today, those priests are retiring and dying, and many of the churches they served are closing.
It's not that we don't have priests going into the future. We do, but it's at only about a third as many as we would need to compensate for those that entered 50, 60 years ago.
This is the challenge facing vocation directors like Father Romano in Camden. He's hesitant to pin all of his hopes on the so-called Francis effect. He says there are many reasons why men do or don't act upon a sense of call.
We do apologize for technical difficulties, only to note that as you prep for the Pope, you can find out what famous Philadelphia chefs would serve to Pope Francis in our weekly feature entitled Feeding Francis. This and more special coverage at whyy.org/Pope in Philly. Taking a look at this evening's headlines, Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane faces questions over the speech she delivered last week in response to criminal charges filed against her. The event was held in a state media facility and managed by her state employee and state-paid security detail, but she focused on her personal criminal defense. Citizen activist Jean Stilp filed a complaint today with the State Ethics Commission, maintaining her use of state resources and employees in a personal matter represents a conflict of interest. A Kane spokesperson says her elected office entitles her to use state resources. A new rule released today from the Environmental Protection Agency aims to cut methane emissions from the oil and gas industry. The rule mainly addresses emissions from new oil and gas operations. Environmental groups in Pennsylvania say the state should impose more regulations on wells and pipelines that already exist. The Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection says it is considering this type of regulation, though the state's gas industry maintains it's already lowered its methane pollution, and that further regulations are both costly and unnecessary. 88 degrees, mostly sunny skies on Independence Mall. It's 6:19. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. Clouding up overnight, falling back to 72 degrees. Tomorrow, cloudy in the morning, turning partly sunny, though there is a 30% chance of scattered showers, maybe even a thunderstorm. Humid, high 88 degrees. Thursday, remaining overcast, sticky with a 50% chance of rain, high 86. Showers likely on Friday, high 82 degrees, and ahead to the weekend. Enjoy partly sunny days Saturday and Sunday, high both days in the mid-80s. It's 6:19. You're listening to WHYY-FM. Still ahead, as many bemoan the lack of decorum in today's presidential election cycle, a look at earlier campaigns makes this era pale by comparison.
They said that if Jefferson was elected, the entire civic fabric would go to pieces and there would be murder, rape, and mayhem all over the land.
Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Karen Treatment Center supports WHYY. Is someone you care about struggling, losing interest in activities they loved? Changes like these can be a sign of drug and alcohol abuse. As a behavioral health care and addiction treatment center, Karen helps families understand when professional help is warranted, offering therapies that restore wellness in body, mind, and spirit. A confidential assessment is available at 855-894-4325 or at karen.org. That's C-A-R-O-N WHYY.org.
WHYY volunteers help with everything from membership campaigns to exciting events to day-to-day tasks, and their valuable time and effort keeps costs down and maximizes the generous financial support of our members. If you or your group or business is interested in volunteering, please visit WHYY.org/volunteer and enter your information. Groups that answer phones during membership campaigns even receive on-air recognition. Public media would not be possible without people like you. WHYY.org/volunteer. Thank you.
There are career-defining moments in all of our lives, but not all of them involve powerful politicians.
I said, you know, I'm not feeling it. And Hillary Clinton just lifted her face to me and she said, and do what you feel, Chris.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. They also, by the way, don't normally involve red lipstick. We'll tell you more next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Tonight at 6:30 on WHYY.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Donald Trump's inflammatory remarks about Senator John McCain, Mexican immigrants, and most recently Fox News anchor Megyn Kelly have some wondering if we're ushering in a new era of incivility in politics. On this segment of That's History, WHYY's Chris Cetullo and historian Jonathan Zimmerman say that nasty sniping on the campaign trail dates all the way back to the time of the Founding Fathers.
Welcome, Jonathan. Good to have you back.
Good to be here as always.
Okay, Jonathan, today our topic is an historical fallacy much cherished by political pundits. Our political discourse in America has reached a new depth of poisonous toxicity. And if only we could get back to that past golden age of civility where we had such a decorous politics. Why, Jonathan Zimmerman, are those fallacies?
Well, our politics may be nasty and unreasonable for all sorts of reasons, but it has nothing, especially on the 19th century, on the so-called golden age of, you know, civil statesmen. The politics then was much more poisonous, much meaner than our own.
So I'm thinking of the Founding Fathers. Certainly they weren't mean to each other, were they?
Well, Jefferson and Adams ran against each other in 1800, and these are obviously two of the most prominent statesmen in the history of the country. One of them the author of the Declaration of Independence, the other the second president and the first vice president. Although each of them kept a rather low profile, their respective campaigns said things about the other side that I think would shock even today's Trump-tinged ears.
For example?
Well, the Jeffersonian said that Adams wanted to marry one of his sons to one of King George's daughters in order to bring the United States back under British rule. And the Adams camp said that Jefferson was, of course, an infidel. He did have, let's say, rather unorthodox religious beliefs. And because of that, they said that if Jefferson was elected, the entire civic fabric would go to pieces and there would be murder, rape, and mayhem all over the land. And those are the words that they used.
So these are the sacred and blessed Founding Fathers. Surely Abraham Lincoln, revered as he is, wasn't subject to this kind of material.
Oh, no, he was subject to exactly this kind of material and worse.
Yes, and you've provided us with a list of descriptions of Abraham Lincoln that one magazine of the time offered. Let me just run through a bit of it. Liar, thief, braggart, buffoon, usurper, monster, ignoramus, old scoundrel, perjurer, robber, swindler, tyrant, fiend, and butcher.
But Chris, let me emphasize, there were some bad things as well. It wasn't all peaches and cream back then.
I understand. So surely, you know, after we got past the nastiness of the Civil War and the country was reunited, this stuff toned down, right, during the Gilded Age.
Not at all. If anything, it accelerated. In 1876, the much-contested Hayes-Tilden election, the Democrats, the Tildenites, said that Hayes had stolen money from dead Civil War soldiers and had shot his mother. And Hayes's camp, the Republicans, simply replied that Tilden was a syphilic, that he had syphilis.
Okay, well, that's clearly an excellent rejoinder to that discussion. I'm presuming that this level of discourse continues into the 20th century as well.
It absolutely does. And sadly, race is often at the heart of it. So you find that Democrats say of Warren G. Harding that he was secretly black. During the New Deal, anti-Semites said that Franklin Roosevelt was secretly Jewish. They talked about the Jew deal. And I would say in some ways the so-called birther charge against President Obama is a legacy of that tradition. Of course, nobody is questioning his race, but they are charging that he isn't exactly what he seems, right? They're questioning his nationality, sometimes his religion. And yet I would argue that the fate of the birther screed, if you will, shows actually a very sharp distinction between our time and the earlier times, insofar as the birther idea never really got into the mainstream campaign environment.
Thank you, Jonathan Zimmerman.
Okay, thanks. It was fun.
Historian Jonathan Zimmerman spoke with WHYY's Chris Cetullo. Well, it's taken 14 years, but the cast and crew of the PBS staple Ask This Old House finally made it to Delaware, as WHYY's Mark Eichmann explains.
With hammers and saws in hand, the crew of PBS Ask This Old House rolled into Wilmington. This charming home nestled in the Union Park Gardens neighborhood gave the show a chance to cross another state off its list. Wilmington residents Joel Softley and Jane Chesson reached out to the show to get some help with a few repairs around their home.
I feel like we really lucked out. We sent them an email a little while ago asking for some help with some different projects we had around the house, and they contacted us back and said they'd never been to Delaware and would love to come.
Straight up and away. Up.
Armed with tools, lights, cameras, and a monitor, the crew gets to work. Host Kevin O'Connor tackles a child-proofing project.
Well, we're going to keep them out of the nasty stuff, so we're going to lock up the cabinets in the kitchen so they don't get to the things that are typically underneath of the kitchen sink.
Next plumber Richard Trethewey has a project in the bathroom.
Today we are changing out a pedestal sink. The homeowners got here about 7 years ago. They looked down and it has a big crack in it. It didn't leak, but it cracked, and it's the only bathroom, so we thought we'd get them a new pedestal.
All these connections are in a tight little spot to make the faucet.
While Trethewey always makes it look so easy, he says there are some challenges, especially working in a small bathroom with a 7-person crew.
That's the hardest thing, actually.
Whether it's a small bathroom or dark basement, it's the job of senior producer Heath Rosella to figure out how to make it all work.
I oversee all the projects, figure out what stories we want to tell, and help put the camera in the right place and make sure that we're providing great lessons for people at home.
One lesson viewers will not see on the air is that sometimes the job requires tools or parts that are not on their well-stocked truck. When that happens, Richard turns to homeowner Joel, who is more than willing to be Richard's gopher.
Yep, we went to the store, we got a couple parts that we needed, and basically I'm just kind of helping him along, holding things and just kind of seeing how the inner workings of the whole sink and everything. So it's really interesting process.
The episode featuring the repair work in Wilmington will air later this fall. From the Delaware Desk, I'm Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
And that's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas, with help today from Alex Lewis. You can listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.